This radio station.
You talking to me?
Hi, this is Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.
And it is 9 p.m. Monday evening, time for the joy of resistance here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org.
Joy of resistance, we're sisters of the joy of resistance. No corporation, government, religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Keeping organized together, we have come a long distance. Joy, joy of resistance. Sisters of the joy of resistance. No corporation, government, religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy.
And here we are again. The Joy of Resistance, Multicultural Feminist Radio at WBAI. My name is Fran Luck. I'm here with Halsey Hazard, and we bring you Frontline Feminism every week at 9 p.m. on Mondays. We have a really exciting show tonight, speaking of front lines. As you've been listening to the terrible stories of women, particularly feminists, professionals, outspoken women in Afghanistan, often trapped in Afghanistan and on lists for reprisals from the Taliban. As you've been hearing these stories, I'll bet you have felt helpless, as I know I have felt, about not being able to get some of those women out. Well, our guest tonight is a lawyer who is busy with a team of feminists from many countries who have gotten together across all kinds of cultures and boundaries to do just that. Her name is Melanie Shapiro Esquire. She's an immigration attorney specializing in asylum, working with survivors of domestic violence and other forms of abuse. She is a law professor, and we'll introduce her a little more fully when we get to her in a little while. And she is working with this small team, and so far they've gotten 30 or 40 women out of Afghanistan, and right now we're working to get some of them out of camps, refugee camps, where they have landed, which are dirty, unsanitary, and there's a lot of sexual harassment in them. So we're going to be speaking with her about the situation and giving you some ways that you can help in this effort. That's in our first segment. Our second segment, we are going to have feminist activists who have just done a street artist action. I should have said they're feminist artist activists. And three of them on September 8th did a commemoration and protest of the life of a Cuban-born artist named Ana Mendieta. Mendieta, M-E-N-D-I-E-T-A, Ana Mendieta, who was either pushed or fell out of a window 35 years ago in 1985 on September 8th, and whose memory will not die. The three women did this protest that is in a long line of protests by feminists because this woman's life and death touched a lot of nerves in the feminist community and is a kind of flashpoint. The segment will not only be about the most recent action, but some other actions that have gone on over the years in the name of Ana Mendieta. We'll be talking about her art, her life, her influence, and how she was treated by the art world, which is very iconic of how women in the art world are still treated. So that's going to be a very interesting and deep and exciting segment. Hope you will stay tuned for all of that. We're going to start our program with a wrap-up of some of the feminist news. Tonight we are featuring a few stories on the aftermath of the terrible Texas abortion ban, which you've been hearing so much about. And we will be covering that in detail on all of our shows, right at the beginning of our shows in the news. And we have been covering, of course, the struggle to have and maintain reproductive rights in this country for the 19 years that we've been on the air. And we do that in depth and with the most important leaders on our program. So we hope you'll stay tuned right now for the Feminist News.
All right. We have a lot of news stories for you this week. So first, after the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the Texas law that bans all abortions after 6 weeks, women seeking abortions are flocking to other states, including neighboring Oklahoma, where 5 new restrictive abortion laws are set to take effect November 1st. The Texas law empowers private citizens to enforce the ban by bringing a civil suit against anyone they suspect of having or even helping someone get an abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. This, of course, is well before most women even know that they're pregnant. As a result, Texas abortion clinics have closed, overwhelming abortion providers in nearby states and forcing women in need of abortions to travel sometimes hundreds of miles in the midst of a pandemic. Activists are concerned that other states will follow suit if these laws are not successfully challenged. The new Oklahoma laws are being challenged on constitutional grounds by the Center for Reproductive Rights, Planned Parenthood, and other organizations. One of the laws is a 6-week abortion ban, and another effectively bans all abortions by revoking doctors' licenses if they even perform an abortion, even while another bill limits the doctors who can legally perform abortion to licensed OBGYNs. Two other bills place harsh restrictions on medication abortion. Nancy Northrup, president and CEO of the Center for Reproductive Rights, said in a statement, quote, "The Oklahoma Supreme Court has found time and again that the state legislature's extreme attempts to restrict abortion are unconstitutional. These laws would end abortion access in Oklahoma, forcing patients to travel great distances and cross state lines to get essential health care," quote.
Okay. And far-right governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, drew widespread ridicule after claiming he intended to, quote, eliminate all rapists from the streets of Texas when he was asked by a reporter why the abortion ban he signed into law didn't include exceptions for women who are victims of rape and incest. Abbott also said there was no need for such an exception because women would have 6 weeks in which to get an abortion. The Texas governor is obviously unfamiliar with how women's bodies actually work. Most women don't know they are pregnant at 6 weeks. In response to Abbott, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez pointed out Abbott's basic ignorance of biology. She said, quote, "I'm sorry that we have to break down biology 101 on national television, but in case no one has informed him before in his life, 6 weeks pregnant means 2 weeks late for your period, and 2 weeks late for your period for any person with a menstrual cycle can happen if you're stressed, if your diet changes, or for really no reason at all. So you don't have 6 weeks." And in terms of jailing rapists, Texas has an abysmal record. There were more than 600 allegations of sexual assault in Austin, the Texas capital city, and its surrounding county in 2017. Only one person was found guilty by a jury. None of the 496 cases reported to the Austin police made it to trial that year. And I might add that while Texas is a particularly bad example, the situation that only 2% of cases brought for rape ever see jury trials holds across the country.
All right, thanks, Fran. And now for some international news. Just days after the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the near-total Texas abortion ban, Mexico's Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional to punish abortion as a crime and opened up the possibility that women in Mexico will have more reproductive rights than women in Texas. 8 of 11 justices voted to revoke a law in the Mexican state of Coahuila that punished women who received abortions with up to 3 years in prison, and that was even if the pregnancy was the result of a rape. The other 3 justices then joined in the unanimous decision to decriminalize abortion and all other laws like that one. Though their ruling does not legalize abortion outright, it is a landmark decision for the predominantly Catholic country and sets a precedent that activists hope will inspire judges and state-level courts to make similar decisions in favor of abortion rights. The ruling comes as a result of a growing women's rights movement in Mexico and in other parts of Latin America. In 2007, Mexico City legalized abortion, and since then, several other Mexican states have followed suit. In recent years, millions of Mexican women have protested against femicide and violence against women, donning the green handkerchiefs worn by members of the Ni Una Menos movement that also fought for and won the right to legal abortion in Argentina last year. Of the recent ruling, Rebecca Ramos, the executive director of GIRE, a reproductive rights group in Mexico, told the New York Times, quote, "It's an enormous step towards legalization in the entire country. We are absolutely ready to present legal challenges to the denial of safe and legal abortion." Activists also had words of hope for their neighbors in Texas. Quote, "If there is a message, it is to look at the leadership of Mexico here. This is possible. It is happening," end quote. That's Giselle Carino, the chief executive of the International Planned Parenthood Federation's Western Hemisphere region. He goes on to say, quote, "When you have adverse conditions, like in Texas, you need to double down your efforts."
Hear, hear. All right. Now we're going to some news out of the Taliban-controlled country of Afghanistan. Despite the threat of violent beatings and retaliation, hundreds of women marched in the streets of Kabul on Tuesday, September 7th, calling for the Taliban to respect their rights and making it clear that they would not easily surrender the gains they have made over the past two decades. As the demonstration grew, at least a dozen Taliban pickup trucks raced toward the crowd, and when the Taliban fighters dismounted from them, they shot into the air and people started running. Witnesses reported the soldiers beating demonstrators with clubs and rifle butts. Two reporters have been photographed with marks of floggings on their back received at the hands of the Taliban after these reporters had covered the demonstration. The protest on September 7th was the second demonstration involving women in the nation's capital in less than a week. That's the capital of Afghanistan. And it was also the second to be crushed violently. It came after a number of other demonstrations for women's rights that have taken place in Afghanistan since the U.S. withdrawal became imminent. But on September 11th, a different kind of demonstration took place. Hundreds of women, completely covered head to foot in black, marched in support of the Taliban, carrying uniform signs to this effect, and apparently with the Taliban's complete support. The Taliban cleared traffic to allow passage of buses carrying the demonstrators, issued press releases praising the demonstration, and flanked the march in person, having announced that this was for the women's protection, although their presence also served to keep away reporters from the march, and they would not allow them to speak with any of the women. The above strongly suggests that the demonstration was orchestrated by the new government in an attempt to salvage its image with regard to women and head off the messages of the earlier women's demonstrations. In the weeks since their takeover, evidence has mounted that the Taliban have returned to their earlier policies of forcing women to stay home unless accompanied by a male family member, closing girls' schools, firing female workers, and beating and torturing women who will not conform to living constricted lives. They have also reneged on promises of appointing women to their ruling body, which is now solely composed of men. And on a historical and an editorial note, it is a time-honored tactic of oppressors to claim that the oppressed really like their oppression. For instance, the American slavocracy continually played up images of happy slaves singing and dancing. And, unfortunately, there are always some among the oppressed who can be bribed, threatened, or fooled into supporting those in power. Against their own interests, of course. For instance, during the 75-year struggle for women to have the right to vote, groups of women appeared who advocated for women to not get the right to vote. These groups were supported and often referred to positively by those in power who did not want women to vote in order to buttress their image, divide women from each other, and spread confusion. And that is some of the worldwide feminist news. The news was written by myself, Fran Luck, by Halsey Hazard, and by Pete Dolak. And it was read by myself, Fran Luck, and by Halsey Hazard. We hope you will stay tuned for an incredible interview with immigration lawyer Melanie Shapiro, who is helping to get women out of Afghanistan and out of refugee camps. So please stay tuned. You're listening to a little bit of the Afghan Women's Orchestra, and I'm really sad to say that under the new Taliban rule, women and all people have been told to get rid of their instruments, and all orchestras have been disbanded, including that, you know, very hard-fought for women's orchestra. We'll be hearing a little bit of that also a little bit later. Well, I've heard of our next guest really through an article in 4W. It's the number 4 and the letter W, which stands for 4 Women, which is a blog that I sometimes read. And Phyllis Chesler, the feminist author, had spoken about getting a letter from a woman named Aisha, which is a pseudonym, who felt trapped in Afghanistan, who was trapped in Afghanistan, and as an outspoken and professional woman with a medical degree, she knew she'd be a target, and she was really begging activists around the world to get her out. Chesler said, "I am thrilled to share the answer to the question of how we actually got her out. She has a team of what she calls radical feminists, anti-trafficking, anti-sex slavery activists and experts, honor-killing experts, Europeans and Americans, some Christians, a Sikh, she says maybe some atheists, perhaps a goddess worshiper or two, who knows, it is my honor and privilege to be among them." One of the foremost activists she mentions on this team is Melanie Shapiro, Esquire, an immigration attorney specializing in asylum and working with survivors of domestic violence and other forms of abuse. She's an adjunct law professor at Roger Williams University School of Law. And before becoming an attorney, she focused her work on combating sex trafficking and co-founded Citizens Against Trafficking with Donna Hughes. Melanie Shapiro, are you on the line? Are you there, Melanie?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Now I can hear you. Why don't you say hello again and see if we can hear you.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. I'm thrilled that you can join us. I know you're in a hotel room with a cell phone and your sound may be a little foggy, so I hope people will really try to listen to what you have to say. So you are working to get women trapped in Afghanistan, particularly women likely to be targets of the Taliban because they are feminists, out of Afghanistan and also out of the refugee camps in which many of them have gotten trapped. Would you begin by telling us something about the situations you're running into of women in Afghanistan, perhaps a story or two that kind of illustrates what's happening, and then we'll go on to what you are doing.
Yeah, sure. I can start with one of the cases that we just got out of my office a couple of days ago is a woman who is an engineering student, and she was married when she was very young. She was forced to be married to a man. She wound up getting divorced. He beat her within an inch of her life and has since joined the Taliban. He has hired a lawyer who is trying to track her down. She has to keep moving. And the Taliban are going door to door looking for these women who are not in line with their regime, and these women who are at risk that we're trying to get out, including this woman I'm mentioning, she is hiding in an apartment, and she informed me that she saw the Taliban go in and raid one of the houses across the street from her the other day. She's terrified. We've applied for something called humanitarian parole for her to come to the United States, but this can take a couple of weeks, so she's just trying to stay hidden at the moment so she's not leaving. And this echoes a lot of the other stories that we have of women who are trying to get out, and for one reason or another, the Taliban is hunting them. Whether we have another one I'm thinking of, she's an attorney, and she works in the government on issues of gender and women's rights, and she is in hiding. She has to keep moving. The Taliban are hunting her. I have another woman who said that, she told me the other day, she's a women's rights activist. She told me the other day that some women were trying to stand up to the Taliban and the Taliban were shooting them. So these are some of the conditions that we're facing. And also, I have some other situations where before the U.S. pulled out, they were issuing these very generic visas with not much information on them, not even the women's names, and generic letters allowing them to leave through the airport in Kabul. But now, you know, because of reasons, you know, some women were beaten on their way to the airport. Some had gotten sick and had to turn back. And for whatever reason, they weren't able to get into the airport. These visas are basically useless now. And even though they had this visa, they are trapped in Kabul and they don't have a means out. So we're trying to work with the bureaucracy of the State Department to try to expedite cases, to try and update these visas, or to try and find other ways for them to get out of the country.
Wow. These are terrible, terrible stories, and I know there are many, many more of them. We're speaking with Melanie Shapiro, who is an immigration lawyer, actually working, I believe, out of Massachusetts, who is working with a team of feminists in many countries who are trying to use all of their skills to help extricate some of these women who are trapped and who are in fear for their lives out of Afghanistan. Melanie, what can you do for somebody who is in that, who is sending you these messages? And I'm also curious how you're communicating. And I understand you can't give us all the details. But tell us about the work of getting these women out. What do you do to do that?
I can to an extent, but there, at least what I'm doing is I am coordinating all of the legal services. I have over 40 women, some with family members, that we are helping to with the legal remedies of trying to get papers to get them out, and also coordinating with some other feminists in different countries who have some connections to get them out over land or private flights. So it's kind of organizing the funding. We're trying to fundraise, though it's abysmal at this point. We definitely need a lot more funding. And then trying, on my end, I'm trying to set up we need sponsors to sponsor them in the U.S. I'm trying to find some housing. We recently set up, because a lot of the women are in crisis in some of the camps emotionally. We had a woman who is suicidal, so we are setting up a network of volunteer feminist therapists who are willing to talk to them. I'm connecting with a lot of them through WhatsApp.
You said WhatsApp?
One of the things I wanted to bring up.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is that recently a message went around that the social media forums are being monitored. So what used to be safe communication, like these apps, WhatsApp, Signal.
Excuse me, Melanie, are you saying they're being monitored by the Taliban?
Yes. Yes,
wow.
This is now being referred to as cybercrime. Any sort of posts or videos regarding politics or the present situation about the government. This is being termed cybercrime.
By the Taliban in Afghanistan.
By the Taliban, that's right. And so people are warning their friends and family members in Afghanistan to be very careful and to take care to not send unnecessary messages or, you know, they're facing arrest without a warrant or attack. So we were communicating with some clients on WhatsApp, and we have three women, for example, that they're switching places every single day, and they don't have a WhatsApp because it's not safe. So we're having a really difficult time trying to help them because we can't communicate with them.
In other words, you have been able to communicate with women in Afghanistan through your computer, through certain applications, and that's how the communication has been working. Okay. According to Phyllis Jesler, there were also people on the ground. She talked about Marine contacts and all kinds of helpful people that contacts through various sources that were also pitching in to help hide these women. Have you been involved in anything like that?
I've heard about that, and I came on when we were trying to help the woman referred to as Aisha.
Yes.
So I know that Phyllis has spoken with some former military people who have been helpful in terms of providing information, but I know that there were some people on the ground that were helping guide some of the women to the airport.
Nowhere. Okay. So apparently a lot of women with different kinds of connections have been cooperatively working across different countries to try to work with specific women and get them out. If a woman, Aisha did get out, and she actually got through the refugee camp part of it, maybe you could talk a little bit about the refugee camps and the kind of trap that is for these women.
Yeah, this is very troubling, and this is something I encounter with all of my asylum seekers when they come to the United States or anywhere else. If they're in these communities or camps where they have people who are from their country, we don't know who's safe and who's not safe, who shares the Taliban mentality and who doesn't. So they have to be very careful. A lot of women have been facing sexual harassment in the camps, and a lot of women have been telling us that the conditions are not good, the food is not good. It's been really hard for some of them, and as I mentioned, we have one woman who said that the conditions of the whole situation and everything that she's been going through, and she is in the United States, she said, it's so terrible, I wish the Taliban had just killed me.
Wow. We are talking with Melanie Shapiro, who is an immigration lawyer, who is part of a team that is helping to get women out of Afghanistan. This is The Joy of Resistance, Multicultural Feminist Radio at WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City and WBAI.org on the web. Melanie, let's talk about what our listeners who would like to do something to help to change, to ameliorate this terrible situation, can do.
Yeah, thank you. There's a lot of things you can do. We are collecting money through 4W, and also we have what's set up as the Afghan Feminist Refugee Fund. And so donations to that would be really helpful. If you can't provide any sort of money towards the cause, that's fine. There's other ways that you can get involved. But just for those who do donate, my office is meticulously handling all of the money that comes in. We're using the money for filing fees for these legal documents that they need. We're using it for plane tickets. We paid for somebody to take the English test required for student visa to come to the United States. So any sort of basic needs that are coming up for the women, that's what the money is going towards.
Okay.
If you do not have any money to donate, we are looking for people who have spare rooms, who can host as some of the women at their home temporarily. We're looking for people, when they get here, they'll need things like clothing, and food and so forth. And we also, as I mentioned, we have volunteer therapists. So a lot of these women have been through so much, and they're in crisis mode. So just having someone to connect with on WhatsApp to help them through what they're going through or through another means is really helpful. Just getting the word out about what we're doing. One of the things that is most important, I think, at this point is finding someone who can sponsor them by filling out a form for humanitarian parole. Without someone who's a U.S. citizen or a permanent resident who can sign this form for them, they're not even allowed to apply for humanitarian parole. So finding sponsors is a really big way to help.
Okay, so give us a website, give us some contacts, and repeat that a couple of times so people can get out a pencil and paper or go onto their cell phones or whatever and make a note of this. Tell us, women who are listening right now, men, anybody who wants to help, some of these women who are literally fleeing for their lives, and some of whom may come to the United States and need some help here, where should they go? Who should they contact if they want to help?
Well, they could contact me directly. Or you can go on my website and contact me. It's just Melanie, M-E-L-A-N-I-E, Shapiro, S-H-A-P-I-R-O-E-S-Q.com.
Repeat that again. What2.com?
Melanie Shapiro, E-S-Q.com.
Oh, E-S-Q. We're talking about Esquire. Right. That suffix that lawyers have. Melanie Shapiro Esquire. One word?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, that's just the website. You can just contact me through the website.
Okay.
Shapiro. I'll give you the number for the office.
Wait a moment. Is Melanie Shapiro Esquire at .org or .com or?
.com.
.com. Okay, I'm going to say that again. Melanie Shapiro, S-H-A-P-I-R-O, Esquire, E-S-Q, period, .com. All
right. That's right. And the phone number you could call is 781-461-0100.
Okay, 781-461-0100, 781-461-0100. We'll repeat that at the end of the show. Melanie, we're just about out of time. I would like us to keep in touch, and I'd like you to give us updates on what is happening. You are really on the ground, as they say, and I guess you're in the air, too, through the computer, but you are in the front lines one way or another, and you are helping to get women out of a really death-dealing situation trapped in Afghanistan. The women who are feminists are not seen very favorably by the religious fundamentalists, and they are in fear for their lives. That is happening now. Melanie, I can't thank you enough. I'm so moved by what you and your team is doing, and we will be in touch, and I hope our listeners will volunteer in one way or another to help also. Once again, that's Melanie, M-E-L-A-N-I-E, Shapiro, S-H-A-P-I-R-O, Esquire, E-S-Q, that's it, E-S-Q, .com. That's all one word, no spaces. Melanie Shapiro, Esquire, .com. Please get in touch with her. Once again, Melanie, thank you so much for what you are doing. It is amazing that you are doing that work.
Thank you so much, Fran, for having me on and supporting the work that we're doing.
Yeah, wonderful. All right. And we are now going to take a musical break, and then we're going to go to our second segment tonight, which is we're going to be speaking to a number of women who have been active in keeping alive the memory of Ana Mendieta, who was a Cuban-American artist who met her death in a very mysterious fall some 35 years ago. And we're going to be looking at why women, even young women who weren't alive when she died, are moved to be doing actions in her name and keeping keeping her situation and her art and who she was alive. We'll be speaking to three of those women who just did a commemoration on the anniversary of her death on September 8th last week. So please do stay tuned. Right. Do we have our guests on the line?
I certainly hope so.
I do too. All right. You've just been listening to a 2011 performance of Guaguanco, which is a Cuban rumba, and it's by Camarata Ramon and an all-female string orchestra founded in Havana in 1993. And that is our introductory music to the next segment of Joy of Resistance, where we will be talking to, first of all, three women who did an action, an art action, in memory of an incredible woman artist. And we're going to be saying why they did that and why feminists have been doing actions in her name for 35 years since she died. Why is her name, her life, and the situation she was in as a woman artist such a flashpoint for feminists? So, my guests right now, who I hope to have on the line, are Tamara Windham. Just say hello if you're there.
Hi.
Hi. Good, glad you're there. Tamara is an artist who has been very influenced by Mendieta's work, and she's going to tell us why and what the action was that was just done on the sidewalks of New York. And then we're going to be speaking with, I believe it's J.D. Fleischman, who is a 60-year-old performance artist, poet, sex worker, and sound healer. And we also hopefully have on the line C.C. Burton, who is an artist. And we may even have Mary Anna Pomonis, who participated in another protest about Ana Mendieta, and that was in 2017, and who helped compose a letter that was signed by hundreds of art world figures. We're going to find out what all of that was about. So let's see who else is there. Do we have J.D. Fleischman? J.D., are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hello.
Hello. So glad you could be on Joy of Resistance. And we also have C.C., who is an artist. And you can just say hi, so I'll know you're there, C.C.
Oh, yes. Hi. How are you?
Hi. And we may have Mary Anna Pomonis, who is a member of the Association of Hysteric Curators, a group that focuses on feminist issues and the representation of women and art. And she participated in another action around Anna Magnetta, and we're going to be talking about that. Are you there, Mariana?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Oh, my goodness. I've got the whole crew. Hello. All right. So we have about 20 minutes, and we're going to go one at a time. First of all, let me just mention a little bit about Anna Magnetta, and the rest of you can fill in if I leave out something. She was a Cuban-born artist, and at the age of 36, she either fell or was pushed out a window. And some people believe the perpetrator was her husband, who was very famous artist Carl André, and who was tried for her murder but was acquitted. But there are still many unresolved questions about what happened to her. One of them is the fact that her career was beginning to blossom, and she was going to have her first public showing in L.A. And it's just very unlikely that she committed suicide, which I think was the implication at the trial. And there was a lot of anger about her death and about the lack of justice. And there was also anger when her husband, who may have been the perpetrator, I don't know for sure, but that was a lot of feeling that he was, wound up having a lot of single-person exhibitions when Anna Magnetta had never had that kind of attention to her work, even though her work is very influential and significant. So a lot of issues crossed here, how women in general are treated in the art world. This particular woman was a woman of color, and that made her treatment even worse. And also the lack of justice in her death, because she's thought to be a great talent. So with that as the introduction, I want to turn to Tamara Windham. And Tamara, why don't you tell us something about why you did the demonstration last week on Mercer Street in Manhattan.
Thank you. I want to say that Magnetta really inspired me, and she explored female identity through many different mediums. And she was especially known for what she called her silhouette work, silhouette meaning silhouette, using natural materials and sometimes her own body to make a female form in the landscape. But she also did performance in male drag with a fake beard, and she spilt blood on a sidewalk and photographed people looking at it, and she did a lot of different things. I first saw Anna Mendieta's work in the feminist art journal Heresies in the early 1980s. Anna Mendieta's work and other feminist art of that time helped me to accept myself as a woman and to accept my own body, as I did not feel good being female when I was young, and this was very healing for me. Also, Anna Mendieta's connection to nature was compelling. And I want to point out that in the book, The Second Sex, Simone de Beauvoir writes about how young women and girls often feel free only when they're in nature, and I have also felt this way. I wanted to do a street performance memorial for Anna Mendieta about 2 years ago, but the pandemic kept us from doing that until mm-hmm. this year. The mm-hmm. location where she died is within walking distance of where I live, and within walking distance of where my friend J.D. lives, so that gave us a very organic place to start. Mm-hmm. And we conceived of making a silhouette similar to Anna Mendieta's art, but not a copy of any specific piece of hers. And it was very inspiring. It was on Waverly Place near Broadway. She fell on the roof near there. Now I'm going to hand it over to J.D. Fleischman, who's going to describe more about what we did.
Great. Hello? Welcome to the airwaves, J.D.
Hey, thanks. Before the new normal in 2019, Tamara and I presented a ritual for the Milk Moon, and in 2019 October, a Milk Moon ritual at West Beth. As the shutdown shut down, naturally we spoke of how to work together again, private space versus public action. Shamanic intervention one. Tamara suggested an action to mark the life, the art, the death of Anna Mendieta, exactly where she died, in a manner she'd approve. Asking artists we knew, 'twas C.C. Burton who rose to action. All good. 1 a.m. September 6th, two cans of orange day glow spray paint and I sashayed to Waverly and Broadway, the place where she died. In large, good girl script, I tagged, ¿Dónde está Ana Mendieta? Daybreak, 6 a.m., we three met there. Plus noted photographer Nikki Johnson, our documentarian. What followed wasn't scripted, just imperfect, pure perfection. CC dressed in sacrificial white, her back slathered with paint, the color of dried blood. On the filthy sidewalk, CC lay, encircling her supine form with a roughly painted silhouette of dried blood. Tamara followed with dried beet powder. Together, we circled her slender body with blood-red rose petals. A Santeria horsetail broom swept all the ghosts away, and a wooden Santeria machete de Puerto Rico cut those cords. From a new moon gong emerged a steady, soft, slow heartbeat. Ba-boom, ba-boom. Ever so gradually, increasing volume and speed and intensity till a huge kaboom. Silence ensued. The gentle breeze tumbled rose petals over our CC's so still body. Tiny baby hairs on all our necks and drums and arms rose. I swear it. We heard a sigh. I swear it.
I want to interject this beautiful poetic rendering of the sidewalk action you and two of our other guests did last week, with letting our audience know that they can see a picture of what you've just described if they go right now to the WBAI website at WBAI.org. Near the top, there's an upcoming program highlights, and all of us producers get to write about what we're going to be producing, and we get a photograph. And the photograph is of CC surrounded by this, what I'm calling fake blood, which you're calling a whole lot of other poetic things, and it's all the same. And they can also see the graffiti, which you also did, which was in bright orange. It was almost the rallying cry of the Anna Mendieta protests, which is, can you say that, what the graffiti was and what it meant?
Sure. It's Spanish. Ana Mendieta was una cubana. She was Cuban. And it said, ¿Dónde está Ana Mendieta? Where is Ana Mendieta?
¿Dónde está Ana Mendieta? It is so haunting. And it has survived all of these mini demonstrations for so many years. J.D., if there's anything else you want to say, please do. And I want to read to the audience some of the demonstrations about her that have been happening really almost since her death.
Well, what I'd like to say is no sooner had we done that than the workers in the restaurant came out Mexican. When I explained in Spanish what we were doing, they were sympathetic. But soon after we left, we heard the workers of the restaurant came out and scrubbed the silhouette away. But, you know, spray paint doesn't wash away so fast. It's still there today.
But this is the age of the Internet. And, of course, this was also an action meant to be shown on the Internet. So can you give us a website where people can see more of what you did and see the documentation of it?
Well, best to go, I feel, to Tamara's Windham's Internet Instagram page. and her Facebook presence. And I'm going to pass the phone to Tamara because she knows more about tech than I do.
Okay.
Hi. What do you need to know?
I want to know where the audience members can go to see the documentation of the action you did. And you also might tell us where we can go to see Ana Mendieta's artwork.
Oh, well, my Facebook page, Tamara Wyndham, W-Y-N-D-H-A-M, has some public posts of the photos that we have. Mm-hmm. And also on my Instagram, which is my name, Tamara Wyndham. Eventually, we're going to post a YouTube video, but I haven't been able to do that yet.
Well, we'll let our audience know when you do. I want to read a little bit of some of the history here. And
we would like CC to speak.
Yes, I want CC to speak also. CC, why don't I ask you why you were so moved to want to do a demonstration? You're a younger woman than the other two. You're in your 20s, I understand. And you weren't even alive when Ana Mendieta fell to her death. And yet you were moved to want to participate. Can you tell us why?
Well, I think that pretty much just being female, I think we've all had perhaps not exactly similar situations and experiences, but I think we can all kind of understand what it feels like to live with someone that you love and to have things that are perhaps not so lovely happen at home. And so I felt, especially like coming from my last relationship, that I had a certain kinship to the story, and also growing up in New York City and having it be something that wasn't really, you know, that well known. I went to school for a while in the West Village. I was always in the art world, and you know, my mother never spoke about this. I think it's a very important story, and especially with Carl still kind of going around, doing his thing, and
Carl Andre,
making money.
Well, many feminists have felt that he was responsible, even though he was acquitted officially of the murder. And then he went on to be so successful, and he got all these retrospectives, and there was no retrospective for Ana's work. And that was the other flashpoint for feminists and why there have been so many demonstrations. And I want to just briefly mention that there was a demonstration in 1992 when the Guggenheim Museum opened a branch in downtown Manhattan. An exhibition that featured work by Carl Andre drew protesters wearing T-shirts with Mendieta's image and her dates of birth and death. Then in 2014, protesters in New York City left a splatter of chicken blood and guts before the offices of the DIA Foundation in response to Andre's retrospective in Beacon, New York. In 2016, in London, a number of Andre works were exhibited, and there was a demonstration there. And in 2017, protesters handed out postcards with an image of Mendieta and the text, "Carl Andre is at MoCA Geffen," that's the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles. "Carl Andre is in MoCA Geffen. Donde está Ana Mendieta?" Where is Ana Mendieta? And protests there took the form of figures outlined on the sidewalk, as in police markings after a murder. And there were even cookies in the form of one of Mendieta's silhouette works. And they were handed to museum goers, along with information about Mendieta. So I want to thank my three previous guests, and I want to move to Ana. I want to move to Mary Ana Pomones, who is a member of a group that has been very faithful to protesting the death, continuing to bring up the issues brought up by Ana Mendieta's death. And that is the Association of Hysteric Curators, who work for the representation, do work around women in the art world and the representation of women. And good evening, Mariana.
Good evening. Thank you for that wonderful and long introduction.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that 2017 protest, not that long ago, your part in it, why you did what you did, and, what you're feeling about it at this point.
Okay. First of all, I'd like to say that the people that organized it for the night of the opening were Lauren Bond, who runs, is an incredible artist, and she's the artist who is responsible for those sort of crime scene-looking silhouettes with mm-hmm. the candles that you see in a lot of photographs of that evening. And then also Joy Silverman, who created that postcard with permission from Anna's sister and was one of Anna's great friends and has continued to keep her legacy alive and to distribute and repeat that phrase all over and over and over again. And I think to Joy's credit, we have not forgotten that phrase. And I think her asking, where is Anna Mendieta all the time, she's contributed greatly to keeping her memory in popular culture and popular consciousness. But aside from that, I think that one of the reasons she remains very, very popular is that her work touches on deep issues that are relevant today, that are very contemporary issues of the body, multidisciplinary work, the earth, eco-consciousness, issues of trauma. These are all things that young artists are really interested in talking about, the idea of being non-binary. Those are things that she explored in her work. And I think that it's looking at it now, her work looks much more contemporary, certainly than Carl Andre's work looks now.
That's right. And yet he still has gotten all the accolades, which leads me to a question I really want to focus on, which is the feelings about the position of women in the art world, which has been the position of women in the art world has been protested since the beginning of the feminist movement in the second wave of feminism in the 1960s and 70s. And it continues because women do not get the exhibition space. They do not get the prices paid for their work that men do. There are so many ways in which women are discriminated against. So I know that's one of the cross currents of why there have been so many demonstrations to this day about Anna Mendieta. Can you talk about that aspect of it?
Sure. Well, I know that for us in Los Angeles, I think it felt really horrible, especially because we had a new director of MoCA at the time, Philippe Verne, who was coming from the DIA, who brought this show with him.
You're talking about that last action in 2017.
Yes,
at the Museum of Contemporary Art. Yeah,
so
go ahead.
When he brought this exhibition to Los Angeles, it's a bizarre exhibition to bring to Los Angeles. MoCA actually owns more than Anna Mendieta's work than Carl Andre's work. They have a whole suite of her silhouette prints that were acquired under the leadership of Alma Ruiz, who was an amazing curator for many years at MoCA. There's always been, just a focus and a fascination with her because of her Latinx identity as a Cuban American, and then also just because of her strongly influential and contemporary work. I mean, I think that the work just looks like work that mm-hmm. young people are still engaging with and still making. And so here comes into that space this multicultural diverse city that's Los Angeles. This work that's very antiseptic, it's very looks very dated. It doesn't look like work that's made today.
That's Carl Andre's work, which is minimalism. He's considered the father of minimalism.
So here you have this imported, very antiseptic show coming to Los Angeles right after the election in 2016. Mm-hmm. And so it seemed like just a triple whammy. So not only was the sort of location of the city not taken into consideration, or the underrepresentation of female artists in the solo exhibitions of the museum up to that point, but you had this just very callous, ignoring that was going on of the real money and power that was pushing this exhibition through the space of the museum. And it was definitely not people in Los Angeles. I mean, Alma Ruiz, who worked at MoCA for many, many years, was on the side of the protesters the night of the evening or the opening. She was definitely not hanging out with her former colleagues at the museum. And she felt that it was wrong. And I think a lot of people there were just very moved to do something, to say something, because it felt like the
And just tell me very quickly, because I'm really afraid we're out of time, Mariana. What moved you? What gets you angry about that you are still keeping that alive after so many years after she died?
Well, just imagine what she could have made had her life not been violently ended.
I'm sorry, could you say that again a little louder?
I think imagine what she could have made. You know,
imagine her work, right?
Yeah, I think that's what hits me the hardest, is knowing that her legacy was impacted by this man who was less talented than her.
And that, okay. Then we're getting to the heart of it. Yeah. I'm afraid I have to cut you off at this point because our show is just about over. There's so much more to say. I'm so glad that all of you are guests tonight. Remember her name, Anna Mendieta, M-E-N-D-I-A-T-A. Look for her work and understand that what she went through as a woman artist and a woman artist of color in the white male-dominated art world is endemic of what so many people